Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Now, I want to mainly talk about pairs of fermionic lithium atoms, but this is a workshop in the conference on frontiers in quantum gases, and at MIT, in collaboration with Professor Pritchard, we have 4 experiments on quantum degenerate gases, and since there have been some major results on the bosonic experiment, I want to share them as well. I won't say a lot about our rubidium BEC experiment, partially because Dominik Schneble, he's in the audience. So if you want to know something about steps with optical lattices, super radiance, ask him. Or also if you want to know what are the tricks and difficulties to make rubidium condensates in excess of 50 million atoms, he's the expert. Now I want to first talk about surface atom optics, namely the observation of quantum reflection with a sodium Bose-Einstein condensate. I guess you all know quantum reflection is the phenomenon which doesn't happen in classical physics, only in quantum physics, that particles are reflected off an attractive potential. Well, if there's a step function in the potential, it's simply a boundary condition, but things are much more subtle if you have van der Waals potential. In order for atoms to be reflected, you need a step function. Well, the step comes as follows. With a van der Waals potential, you can associate a length parameter. And it's actually important to point out that the length parameter is the smaller the van der Waals potential is. So weak interactions means an abrupt change. And now, in order to get quantum reflection, you need the de Broglie wavelengths of the atoms to be longer than the step function. So this has been sort of on people's mind for many, many years. Now, as I just pointed out, for extremely weak interaction, very weak van der Waals coefficient, quantum reflection is easier or happens at higher temperature because the length scale associated with the weak van der Waals potential is small. And for this specific system, hydrogen and helium, you can observe partial quantum reflection at temperatures as high as 1 Kelvin. And some of the pioneering experiments were done by Jörg Walreven, who is in the audience. Now, a lot of those experiments and all normal incidence experiments use system involving hydrogen on helium or helium on helium, and the energy scale for that is 1 Kelvin. Now, for almost all other atoms, the energy scale to observe quantum reflection is more than a million times lower. And people have thought since the early days in laser cooling, maybe at some point we can reach the conditions and do quantum reflection with ultra-cold alkali atoms, but it means this energy scale. And until recently, all experiments did not reach this energy scale, but they were done in grazing incidents, sort of lowering the perpendicular velocity to the surface by extreme angles. So what I want to report now is that we have been able to take Bose-Einstein condensates and reflect them off a surface using normal incidence. Well, I pointed out the challenge is to reach extremely low temperatures, extremely low densities of Bose-Einstein condensates. Otherwise, the mean field energy will take the role of an effective temperature. So it was really a challenge in condensate manipulation, low density, low temperature condensates. And well, last year, we could show that a special gravitomagnetic trap is a wonderful tool to control Bose-Einstein condensates in a new regime of density and temperature. It essentially uses a single coil to levitate atoms against gravity, and then there are some auxiliary coils. In this setup, but this has been published last year, so I don't want to elaborate on it, we were able to use evaporation and adiabatic expansion to break through the 1 nanokelvin barrier and reach picokelvin samples. But this was just sort of a tool. The real goal was to use the tool for quantum reflection. So the idea is now the following. We prepare condensate in sort of the single nanokelvin regime close to the surface, and then we suddenly move the trap into the surface, and then the condensate is accelerated into the surface. And here is what happens. Here's the it's time of flight picture. So you see the condensate appearing on the this line is the surface, on the right side of the surface, because it's moving against the surface. But then you see partial reflection. The tip of the condensate has been reflected. The tail of the condensate is still moving towards the surface, and eventually there's only a reflected cloud.
The surface suddenly do that?
Pardon?
The surface suddenly from this side.
This is the surface, and the condensate is moving towards the surface. And when we do a time of flight analysis and the condensate has not yet hit the surface, the condensate is moving past the surface. Is that clear? There's a surface, the condensate is moving. If you suddenly, held by a magnetic trap, and if you suddenly switch it off, the condensate falls down and appears on the other side of the surface. But if it has been reflected, it appears on that side. And that's what you see here. It's a silicon surface, it's a thin slice of silicon wafer. Anyway, we can just plot the position of the condensate, and that's what we observe. It's sort of an interrupted dipole oscillation in a half harmonic oscillator trap. And we see up to two bounces. We can evaluate the reflection coefficient, and we find that we see up to 20%. The solid line is a curve which without any free parameter, no using the van der Waals potential for sodium with a conducting surface. At very low velocity, we get into the regime where the center of mass velocity, which we plot here, is no longer characteristic for the whole condensate. I mean, the front end moves slower than the tail end, and other things happen. We've done another class of experiment where we took the condensate, put it in an intermediate potential, so the condensate was sloshing into contact with the surface, came to a standstill, and then we were holding it in a surface trap and did a stationary experiment. You would expect, depending what model you make, that all the atoms should be lost after quarter or half trap period, and we see atoms much, much longer than after half a period. A simple model, which is probably not rigorous, but it doesn't make any major assumptions, would predict reflection coefficients in excess of 50%. So, well, we think that's that expands the field into a new direction. We can now use material surface as new elements for atom optics. If you use thin membranes or other spongy surfaces where the reflection coefficient is higher, we may even dream of confining condensates without an electromagnetic field, simply with the material surface. And we should also be at the point where we will soon see collective behavior, namely that density effects, the mean field dominates quantum reflection and not just the kinetic energy. Okay, so this was just a short update on what was going on in one of the other labs. Now, the rest of my talk will be dedicated to Feshbach resonances. We gained a lot of insight into Feshbach resonances by doing them both with bosons, sodium converted to sodium-2, and with fermions. And actually, we have now been doing it with boson-fermion mixtures, but I talk about that at the end. But let me start with pairs of bosonic atoms, and then come to pairs of fermionic atoms. I think no need to explain that after Debbie's talk. Molecules are really new frontier. And if I talk to a general audience, I would simply say what Feshbach resonances mean is that we can transfer the coldness, the low temperature, and all the things we have achieved with atoms into molecules. Because the Feshbach resonance is the point where we can do low temperature chemistry. We go from nanokelvin atoms into molecules without having any release energy due to the chemical reaction. So that's what chemists told us would be impossible, to form molecules out of atoms without heating up the sample. This is realized by using Feshbach resonances. And well, this just shows in a very direct way that when we go through the Feshbach resonance and do time of flight absorption images, we not only see one cloud, the atoms, we see another cloud, the molecules, and they have been separated by a magnetic field gradient, taking advantage of the fact that in this case, the atoms and molecules have different magnetic moments. And you can just talk to a general audience, say, look, this cloud is not any bigger than the atomic cloud, so the molecules have about the same temperature. There was one thing important in the experiment on bosonic sodium, namely when we converted atoms to molecules, that's what we got. But when we blew away the remaining atoms with a laser pulse, we found much, much colder molecules. And that was a clear hint that on sub-millisecond time scales, the molecules were heated up or were even kicked out of the trap by inelastic collisions. So what we observed was we transiently observed temperatures around 50 expansion energies of 50 nanokelvin, from which we could derive a phase-based density of 20. So this is an example very different from the Fermi experiment, which I'll be discussing very soon, where we have a conversion of a gas of coherent atoms into coherent molecules. I want to point out that lifetimes are in this range, 100 microseconds to 10 milliseconds. I want to keep you this number in mind because in the lithium case, the lifetime will be 1,000 times longer. And it's really this factor of 1,000 which drives a lot of current research. But just talking about the theme, which I find is fairly cool, namely the conversion of a coherent atomic gas into a coherent molecular gas, it's really not just similar to, it's absolutely analogous to frequency doubling of a laser. I mean, this is the Hamiltonian AAA dagger which produces it. And if you're concerned that it's not omega but the mass, we can translate from the mass into omega using E equals mc squared. So we really double the energy of a particle in this process. So the question is, how coherent is this process? I told you that by simply doing time of flight expansion, we could measure the temperature. But if you measure the ballistic, well, I say temperature, we measure the expansion energy, and the expansion energy, if interpreted as a temperature, gives us a thermal de Broglie wavelength, and this is a lower bound to the coherence length of the molecular sample. I know I'm talking fast, but I have to go through a few things. So we try to do better now, and the method of choice is Bragg spectroscopy. If you use two counterpropagating laser pulses and couple atoms or molecules out of a cloud, you observe a narrow line width, whereas when you plot the number of outcoupled atoms versus the difference frequency of the two beams. And well, it simply reflects that the kinetic energy which the outcoupled, I have to be careful, I want to say outcoupled atoms, but I mean actually molecules in a moment, the outcoupled particles have, this kinetic energy has to come from the photon energy. And the kinetic energy has a Doppler shift, and so if the Bragg resonance has a broadening, and it's interpreted as Doppler broadening, this corresponds to the momentum distribution of the sample. Well, the momentum width, if you take the inverse of it, gives you the coherence length. So the message is fairly simple. Bragg spectroscopy is a way, without ballistic expansion, without knowing about your initial distribution and other things, to measure the momentum uncertainty or the coherence length of the sample. And now we are applying it to molecules. So I think it's the first time that Bragg spectroscopy has been applied to a molecular sample. We have to use an extra laser, tune it near photo association resonance, but I just want to forego all those these details. So here's a molecular cloud, here are outcoupled molecules, and here are Stern-Gerlach separated, a few atoms which were not fully blasted away by this cleaning pulse. Well, we then take a spectrum, which means we vary the frequency of the lasers and plot the number of outcoupled atoms, we obtain a nice Bragg resonance. And when we fit it, the width can be translated into a temperature of 50 nanokelvin. We were a little bit disappointed because this 50 nanokelvin corresponds to a de Broglie wavelength or coherence length of 1.1 micrometer. It's still larger than the interparticle spacing. So we could prove again through Bragg spectroscopy that we have a quantum degenerate molecular gas with a phase-based density which has a lower bound of about 5. So the answer is yes, we use the second method to characterize the coherent conversion from an atomic gas into a molecular gas. But probably because of random motion, excitations, micrometer motions of the cloud is really broadening the spectrum, we were not successful in establishing a much larger coherence length for the sodium 2 molecules as we could already do by simply looking at time of flight expansion. Now there is another experiment which is important in the context of the fermionic atom pairs, and this is when we studied the decay of the sodium 2 molecules. Well, we will talk a lot, or Debbie has talked a lot, and I will talk more about doing magnetic field ramps from above the resonance to below the resonance. But what we had done already earlier is we did the reverse. We studied the sodium 2 molecules by ramping up the molecule above the Feshbach resonance, and then we studied the bound state, which has now become a metastable or unstable bound state. So what you would expect is the following. If the lifetime of this metastable bound state would be constant, the faster you ramp, the higher you climb up, and the higher is the dissociation energy of the molecules. In a simple picture, you would expect that if the lifetime is constant, the dissociation energy which you measure is proportional to the rate of the scan. If you sweep twice as fast, you climb twice as high, and you see twice the dissociation energy. What we observed when we measured dissociation energy versus ramp rate was not a linear relationship, but a curved relationship, which nicely confirmed that the lifetime of the molecules above the dissociation limit is not constant, but follows a Wigner threshold law. So I'm talking about a two-particle bound state above the dissociation limit, which has a finite lifetime. Okay, let's now talk about fermions. I don't think I have to remind this audience that fermion experiments are always done using a mixture of fermions with bosons or fermions in two hyperfine states, simply because for the evaporative cooling, in a single component fermionic gas, S-wave collisions are frozen out and evaporative cooling doesn't work. Our approach at MIT is unique that it mixes lithium with sodium. And let me just sort of tell you the advisor's perspective on that. You have an already complicated experiment making sodium condensates, and then you go to your students and say, let's make this complicated experiment even more complicated. But let's preserve everything what we have. This was a way in several stages to get reliably large condensates. Now let's extend it to a fermion experiment in the following way. Here is an oven. You should mix lithium atoms together with sodium. In optical fibers, you should mix lithium light with sodium light. You don't change anything else. And then you get simultaneous quantum degeneracy in fermions in sodium. So that was the idea. Just mix the hot atoms, mix the light, and what you get is double quantum degeneracy. Well, I have to give a lot of credit to the people I show later that it really works. And that's Claudio. He built an atomic beam oven where you mix sodium and lithium. It's not so trivial because sodium and lithium differ in vapor pressure by a factor of 1,000. So you can't just mix the metals. You need a two-chamber oven. Well, then you see a mixture of cold atoms, a double mod. Then the atoms are in the magnetic trap. And when we cool down, the sodium forms a Bose-Einstein condensate, and it takes the lithium along for the hike. With recent improvements, the performance is not quite impressive. We have typically 50 million atoms, fermionic lithium atoms, in quantum degeneracy, and we have molecular condensates with multi-million atoms. Atoms, molecules. Okay, so that's all I want to say about the cooling and the production. And all experiments are now done in an optical trap because the interesting system is two hyperfine states of lithium analogous to an electron system, spin up and spin down. And the two states of choice are strong field seeking, so they cannot be trapped magnetically. Therefore, all experiments are done at the focus of an infrared laser in an optical trap, and then variable magnetic fields are provided. So we're talking about the Feshbach resonance in lithium atoms, and the Feshbach resonance is a crossing between a molecular curve and an atomic curve. And I don't have to remind you that on this side we have stable molecules, on the other side molecules are unstable, and also the interaction changes from repulsion to attraction. So let me just in a cartoon picture repeat what Debbie did, namely remind you what do we expect to see on the two sides of the resonance. Well, without interaction we would not be giving these talks because the system is an ideal gas. Everything can be written down or copied from textbooks. The interesting thing is that we have attractions. And for attractive interactions, we have this instability near the Fermi surface, which gives rise to BCS superfluidity, whereas if the interactions are repulsive, there is a molecular bound state, and then of course the lowest energy state of the system is Bose-Einstein condensate in this molecular state. So this gives us the opportunity to study the transition between a molecular Bose-Einstein condensate and a BCS superfluid. Now, just to talk about this crossover from molecular BEC to the BCS limit, Debbie has shown a nice graph. I have done it more in terms of a table, that there is the BCS limit characterized by the binding energies of pairs and the Fermi energy. There is the BEC physics, where you compare the binding energy of the composite particle to the BEC transition temperature. But you can summarize that by simply saying in both systems you have pairs which are bound and you have a quantum degeneracy temperature. And then you realize that those two limits are not two separated pieces of physics, but they can be connected by the BEC crossover. And there is a lot of room to explore in this number, especially the region where this ratio is about one. And this is the physics of the BEC-BCS crossover, which has currently been opened up to experimental investigations. The technique which we are using to produce a Bose-Einstein condensate, Bose-Einstein condensed lithium molecules, is not a Feshbach sweep. So we are not generating the molecules by a two-body process. We are rather staying below the Feshbach resonance, and we are simply evaporatively cooling. And then the colder the gas becomes, the more the particles go to the lowest quantum states, which are molecular in nature, and finally, at even lower temperatures, they Bose-Einstein condense. The fact that this is possible was inspired by work in Paris and Innsbruck. So that's eventually what we did, and November of last year was truly an exciting month when three groups reported observation or evidence for Bose-Einstein condensation of molecules. Now I want to point out that this cartoon picture, you just start with a bunch of atoms, cool them down, and they form molecules. That's amazingly simple. There have been years of discussion, what are the best methods to cool molecules, and the solution is so simple that I would have never dared to ask for it. You put atoms into an optical trap, you ramp down the laser power in your optical trap, the atoms turn into molecules, the molecules turn into Bose-Einstein condensates. I mean, what can be simpler? But the fact that I would not have dared to ask for it is the following. This diagram here, which makes it appear so simple and so natural, is exaggerated, because this is not the whole Hilbert space. The whole Hilbert space has many more molecular states. We are talking about highly vibrationally excited states, and all common sense told us that there will be dramatic, rapid vibrational relaxation to lower states. So we didn't expect this to happen. Well, the reason why we have such extremely long lifetimes of a second or 10 second is, and this was nicely explained by Dima Petrov and Gora Shlapnikov, it's a Pauli exclusion principle applied to the fermionic constituents of the atom. I don't want to go into any further details, but remind you, when I showed you the results on sodium 2 molecules, the lifetime was 100 microseconds to a second. And this is what we expected. And this was just too good to be true. So let me now talk about studies of the crossover region. The lithium system or lithium 2 system is unique that it has this lifetime of many seconds. And we can take a Bose-Einstein condensate of molecules, slowly ramp up, have a degenerate Fermi C, ramp back again. And if you compare those two pictures, it's the same Bose-Einstein condensate. So we can, in contrast to the potassium system, really slowly study the system in full equilibrium, radially and axially, and study the crossover without having to correct and convolute the results for finite lifetime. So in this sort of picture, we are now zooming in on a region right above the Feshbach resonance. And the idea is now, which was first put forward by Debye-Jin and her group, that we may learn something about the momentum distribution of those pairs by sweeping the magnetic field below the resonance. And this is just the reverse of what I presented to you earlier, what we did with sodium-2 molecules when we formed unstable molecules and observed their decay behavior. So the idea is, if this ramp is done fast enough, it may tell us something about the momentum distribution of those pairs above the Feshbach resonance. And well, when we did that, we observed condensation of atom pairs, a condensation phenomenon related to the condensation of lithium atoms, pairs of lithium atoms above the Feshbach resonance. Now, let me talk a little bit about the idea of quickly ramping over the resonance and transform fermionic atoms pair into stable molecules. There are two issues which I want to discuss with that, namely, what is sort of the range of pair size over which this is supposed to work? And the second thing which I want to address with very new experiments is, what is really the time scales which we have to keep in mind when such ramps are done? So let me first talk about the point that, as far as we know, is the Feshbach resonance is something which affects two neighboring atoms. And when we do a sweep, we would expect that the sweep can only transfer neighboring atoms into molecules. But let me first show you some results. When I showed you the condensates of lithium atom pairs above the resonance, I didn't really put numbers on it. And this is actually a big difference to the experiments in Boulder, which were done about 2 months before our experiments. We observed condensate fraction of up to 80%, really high. And this shows that there's 70-80% condensate fraction over a wide range of magnetic fields and temperature. Now, what does this 80% condensate fraction mean in terms of the size of the atom pairs? And let me try to explain it in a cartoon. The question is, we've talked about molecular Bose-Einstein condensate. Are those pair condensates related to something like a BCS superfluid, which in a cartoon way can be shown like this with delocalized atom pairs? And for me, the definition of delocalized atom pair or Cooper pairs is that the atoms are so far away that there are other atoms in between. So that what really constitutes a pair is not diatomic or molecular in nature, it's really a many-body effect with other atoms being in between. Well, I don't think that this is the case. What we are really studying is something in between. You may call this, where the pair size is in between, a crossover superfluid. But now let's just look at this cartoon picture and wonder, if we ramp the magnetic field and we ramp the magnetic field and form stable molecules. I think, I mean, this is my explanation what the magnetic field ramp is. It tells each atom here, find your next neighbor and form a molecule. Now, if I would look at this system, I think there are some atoms who would rather pick their next neighbor from another pair instead of, you know, forming a bound molecule with, you know, the correct partner. So if the density is like this, I would think there are occasionally mistakes. And you would maybe, I think some theorists could do the calculation, if this would be the system and you had 100% of such pairs, maybe the condensate fraction after transfer would only be maybe 50%, because half of the atoms, they grabbed the wrong neighbor. So my intuitive understanding is that an 80% condensate fraction, which we observed, is only compatible with a situation where the pair size is even smaller than shown in this cartoon picture.
So you think it's smaller than in the particle
spacing? I think I'm clearly saying it's based on this picture. I mean, you can believe it or not, it's not quantum mechanics, it's the feeling that the ramp is asking atoms to do diatomic physics, to grab its next neighbor and form a pair. But I think the process is critically dependent on the spacing to the next atom.
And
I can't estimate, but one thing I want to point out, if you compare n and kkf cube, there are factors of 6 pi squares which have to be considered. So if the pair size is kf minus 1, it would still mean that the pair is distinctly smaller than the interatomic spacing. But I think I'm entering now a discussion or something for the panel.
But your 80% is at a 1 over kfa is nominally 0. What's the largest value of 1 over, nominal value of 1 over kfa that you get to? Do you then see a smaller percentage thing?
So this is
what's the largest value of 1 over kfa that you get to?
Well, we go through larger. We have, at fields above 730 Gauss, we have KFA larger one. And then we go.
I'm actually asking the opposite question. Professor, what's the smallest value of one of the KFA? Or what's the smallest value of KFA? And that value is now down from 80%.
I mean, it's just what I showed. I mean, I can just go back. I mean, this is the data. This is KFA, and since the Feshbach resonance is so broad, we never go below KFA on the high field side. We never go below KFA equals 1. Let me just go on. Okay, but there is another very important aspect, namely, is the ramp fast enough to neglect collisions or other dynamics? I know Debbie has done some efforts to vary the sweep rate and see that the condensate fraction is independent of the sweep rate. We have done the sweep after short moment of time of flight, where the density dropped by a factor of 4 and didn't see any difference. But I should say, all the time, I've had some lingering doubts, is the sweep really clean? And I've seen many questions by theorists and other researchers associated with the sweep. Of course, varying the sweep time is ruling out simple collisional models. And starting at different magnetic fields and sweeping down and seeing that the condensate fraction depends on the starting magnetic field, initial magnetic field, this tells us that not everything we see is created by the sweep. But there were, for instance, the question, is the 80% condensate fraction, it's so much higher than in the Boulder experiment, maybe you start with the small condensates and it's bosonically amplified during the sweep. Also, the fact that the condensate fraction did not change with certain sweep parameters, it rules out a simple kinetic model, but there could be certain saturation effects that over a broad range of parameters, the sweep produces very similar results. So for me, the question of the sweep, yes, we had arguments, we had certain experiments which reassured us that simple collisional dynamics cannot explain the result. That was really the question, is the key observation of those condensation of pairs above the Feshbach resonance, to what extent is the interpretation not fully stringent because we have not characterized the complicated physics during the sweep. And well, as experimentalists, we decided to study it experimentally. So what I want to present you now are very recent experiment, time-resolved experiments on what happens in the lithium-2 system above the Feshbach resonance. These are actually just data which are a few days old. So what we did here is, in blue, we jumped the magnetic field from 1,000 Gauss to 840 Gauss just above the Feshbach resonance. And what we observed is, this is shown in red, that the condensate fraction grew from 40% to above 60%. And now there are two timescales. One here, it's an extremely long time scale. It takes 20, 30, 40 milliseconds. But the reason is that we had a lot of overshoot in the magnetic field. The cloud was heated up. And this is the time scale it takes to cool the cloud down again. And you also see that the number of atoms decreases. It's simple evaporation. So that's one time scale. It's a time scale to change the entropy of the system by evaporation. Of course, the blue curve is the magnetic field. The red curve is here the condensate fraction, and here the number of atoms. I need a few more minutes, but I think it's worthwhile. The critical part I have to say here is that the broad Feshbach resonance in lithium means we have two magnetic field sweeps which are 1,000 times faster than in the potassium system. So we really have to switch hundreds of Gauss on microsecond scales, which is fairly difficult. Well, these are really recent data. Friday night, people were running the experiment and got some cleaner data for the short time scale. So what you see here is a magnetic field which just suddenly jumps, it undershoots a little bit and then oscillates, and red is the condensate fraction. So the time scale is now millisecond, and what we observe here is the reaction of a superfluid in an isentropic way. There is no time to change the entropy, there is no time for evaporation. This really measures the intrinsic relaxation time of the system when the magnetic field and the scattering length is changed. So, well, when I discussed it with my group on Saturday, we said, well, the big picture is that the condensate fraction follows the magnetic field, but I would go even further. I see a delay time here. So I think those data show that the condensate fraction follows with a delay time on the order of 200 microseconds. There's actually one thing I should have pointed out before showing you those data. The time scale it takes us and also the Boulder group to cross the Feshbach resonance is typically a few microseconds. Let's say in our experiments it's 4 microseconds to go 100 Gauss through the strongly interacting region. Now, just to play devil's advocate, those 4 microseconds have to be compared to the intrinsic time scale of the system, which is the inverse Fermi energy. Actually, if you say you had a classical gas, unitarity limited and all that, and you would calculate the unitarity limited collision rate, you would find out for our system that the collision time is 2 microseconds. So up initio, by just looking at the system, you cannot rule out that there's dynamics. Of course, 2 microseconds would be a fast collision time, but there's Pauli blocking, there's suppression. On the other hand, for the molecules, there may be bosonic stimulation. So you really don't know what the dynamic of the system is before you measure it. And sort of as of Saturday this weekend, we thought we had a first hint for a 200 microsecond delay time. And if that were true, we don't have to worry about the sweep, because the sweep which takes us through the resonance in 4 microseconds is much, much shorter than the intrinsic relaxation time of the system. Well, I got a phone call this morning that people took data on Sunday night, and these are the results now. So they changed the sweep technique completely. They went from sudden magnetic fields to magnetic field modulation. Maybe some of you are familiar, if you modulate the laser intensity and you record the fluorescence of atoms, there is a phase shift, there is a delay in the atomic fluorescence. It's a way to measure the lifetime of the excited state. Or more generally, if you modulate your system and the system reacts with a phase shift, you measure the correlation function, you measure the intrinsic relaxation time of the system. So what we're doing, and I think this is a whole new class of dynamic experiments on superfluids or superconductors, where you have a superfluid, you modulate the interaction parameter and measure the relaxation time of the system. Something which nobody could do in conventional superconductors and superfluids. So here we modulate, well, that's what people could do in one over the weekend, quasi-sinusoidally, the current and the magnetic field is oscillated between 960 and 840 Gauss. And this is the condensate fraction. And if I put the two together, you observe a distinct phase shift. The time lag is here 500 microseconds. I mean, these are data which are less than they were obtained last night, and I don't want to go into any detailed explanation, but we strongly feel that those data measure the intrinsic relaxation time of the superfluid near the Feshbach resonance. And I want to think about it more, but my first impression is that those data now clearly rule out that the sweep is not creating any artifacts. The system cannot react. We measure now the intrinsic reaction time of the system, and we show that the system cannot react on timescales of the sweep. So we think it's fairly important, and we try to do.
So you conclude that there are no collisions during the sweep across the resonance.
Well, Yes, I think that's what I'm saying. But I always had the uneasy feeling that my estimates for the collision time, the upper bound was 2 microseconds, and it's impossible for us to sweep faster. It's impossible for us because we unplug our power supply and it's really a rapid switch off and we can't do faster. And I think in Boulder, when they want to do faster, they don't create molecules anymore. So there, we can't go much faster through the resonance than in an inverse Fermi energy. And I always had an uneasy feeling, so we decided now not to do estimates for collisions and speculation. We simply take the system, well, at a field, we modulate around 880 Gauss, we go up and down and see how the system reacts. And those data show that the system cannot react on a single microsecond timescale.
So there is the strong power blocking of the collision.
Well, I explained you what we did in the experiment. This is just a few hours old. I just talked to the people over the phone. What it theoretically means, I leave to the discussion here, whether it's Pauli blocking or whatever it is. But I would, with all care, being careful, claim that this is this gives us a clear hint or maybe even a clear value. What is the relaxation time of the system? Okay. So, well, the question is, what is going on here? We feel that the high condensate fraction implies something like pre-existing molecules. And let me be careful because I think some theorists have misinterpreted what we have said. When we say pre-existing molecules, we use the word molecule for something which is distinctly smaller than the interparticle spacing, and therefore what keeps the two particles together is mainly two-body in nature. It may be modified by the medium, but if there are no atoms, other atoms between the two atoms, it looks to me like a molecule. We have no reason to speculate from our experiment, and we've said that explicitly, that the nature of those molecules is unclear. It could be virtual states, it could be scattering resonances, it can be in the open channel, it can be in the closed channel. All we have pointed out, that the nature of those molecules, using this, the reasons I gave, is something which is compact, small, and therefore rather, did I say the nature of the molecules, the nature of the pairs, is rather molecular in character. So one simple model which would explain that would be that we have some scattering resonance, virtual state or molecular level, which is scanned across the Fermi sea, and the pairs above the Feshbach resonance is a condensation in this level, and whatever names you want to put on it. And it's only when this level exceeds the Fermi energy that this kind of condensation phenomenon stops. So that would mean in the picture of localized pairs which both condense that we have followed the BEC physics across the Feshbach resonance. Now the question is, and we will have a lot of discussion at that meeting, where is the BCS physics, the physics where the pairs are so delocalized that other atoms fit in? And there are discussions or theoretical models which say the two overlap. There were discussions that you may have a superposition state of localized pairs and delocalized pairs, or it may simply be a smooth crossover. We think that all experimental results are consistent with the existence of a molecular condensate, but molecule means here tightly bound pairs which are much smaller than the interparticle spacing. But it may very well be that those molecules are identical to Cooper pairs in the tight binding limit. I just want to flash a few slides on heteronuclear fermionic molecules. Since we have sodium as a coolant, we have studied Feshbach resonances in the lithium-sodium system, and we saw lots of resonances. And by doing scans just with sodium alone, we could find out what are new resonances in the sodium system, what are new resonances in the lithium system, and what are, and I think this is the first, Feshbach resonance in a lithium-sodium system where bosons and fermions have a Feshbach resonance. Well, we found several new Feshbach resonances in sodium. All of those except one are D waves and have been interpreted by Ida Tiesinger at NIST. We observed new resonances in the lithium system. One is a P-wave resonance in state 1, 160 Gauss. The other one is a P-wave resonance in state 2. We also looked very carefully again at the Port lithium Feshba resonance. I know that there was evidence in Innsbruck, and there was some discussion with Randy Hewlett, and both of those groups would rather like to see the Port resonance at 830 or 840 Gauss. Well, we really tortured ourselves redoing the experiment, redoing the field calibration, and all we can say, if we do as careful as we can do the experiment, where we take a molecular condensate, raise the magnetic field, and look for the appearance of atoms, that happens at 821 or 822 Gauss. And we've done it as carefully as we can. So that's our result. So we confirm that the onset of dissociation happens at this magnetic field. Finally, we found Feshba resonances which only happen when lithium and sodium are present. So these are the first heteronuclear Feshba resonances. So by scanning here, we convert, or we suddenly lose the sudden drop in lithium and sodium. There are three such resonances. We have not yet seen stable lithium-sodium molecules, but we would expect that there is room for them. But it's actually interesting. We have to do things very differently from the lithium-2. One is there is no Pauli exclusion which prevents lithium-sodium from colliding with sodium or from colliding with lithium. So we have to blow away the lithium, we have to blow away the sodium. And then the interesting thing is, if the lithium-sodium molecule is big, the two sodium parts can easily collide. So we have to make the molecule small, that it's a composite fermion, and then the fermionic nature of the molecule prevents collisions. So stability for Fermi-Fermi molecules requires fluffy molecules, whereas stability for Fermi-boson molecules requires small molecules. At least that's what we think, and we are currently exploring it experimentally. Well, I've exhausted my time. I want to give credit to the lithium team. You see the names and their faces. Thanks.
Did you measure the density profile of your component condensate of fermionic pairs at negative scattering length? Because you say that pre-existing molecules, which means two atoms at a distance from each other smaller than mean interparticle separation. The question is that if these are really molecules on the BEC side, we know the very well-known Thomas Fermi density profile. Yes, okay. What is the size of the, what is the density profile for in the strongly interacting regime at negative scattering length? Is it possible to say?
I would say the most detailed measurements have been done by the Innsbruck group on checking the profile, the density profile below and above the resonance. It's similar to what we have done here. We just ramp up. We can't image in the spatial domain because the cloud is like a spaghetti. We need a little bit of time of flight, but those time of flight pictures reflect the momentum distribution radially, but the spatial distribution axially. And that's what those pictures show. We have not done a very careful study, but we haven't seen anything striking, and I think the Innsbruck group has also seen nothing except a smooth profile.
I have a very short comment and a question. The comment is that I think there is lots of experimental evidence against small size objects like you talk about, and I'll have the chance to talk about that in the afternoon. The question is concerning this varying the magnetic field periodically. Did you try to change the period to make it longer? I understand you can't make it shorter, right? Because it looks like the delay it's linked with the period there, and I'm wondering whether that's the case or not.
Well, we discussed those modulation experiments Saturday afternoon, and here are the data. That's all we did. We've done actually, I was told over the phone, the first tried a more rapid modulation, but we can go slower easily. We can't go faster.
Yeah.
Because this means, I mean, this is not modulating a small voltage. This is modulating 20,000 watt of power. So it's an experimental tour de force. We can do slower, but the feeling is in those modulation techniques, you're usually at your best in terms of resolution if this phase shift is maybe 90 degrees or so. If you do it much, much slower, you would only see a much smaller phase shift.
No, it could be exactly 90. It would be interesting, or it could be different from 90.
You're right. If you would expect that the time delay is the same and not the phase.
It's not a question of what you expect, what if this happens.
We'll do it very soon.
Okay. My question is about observation of how to observe BCS states. So I'm going to spend most of time formulating my question. So if we are in the strong coupling limit, then there are molecules. And if these molecules have long lifetime, then you can use the usual time of flight experiment to see the momentum distribution of molecules. But if we're in the weakly interacting limit, then we're going to have BCS condensate. If you use time of flight experiment, you are basically studying fermions momentum distribution, right? This distribution of BCS state, the difference between BCS state and normal Fermi gas can be very small if the PC is very low. So the question is, what's the low bound on the PC given the current experimental technique we have? How far we can go? I mean, what's the lowest PC we can see in this kind of experiment?
I'm not sure if I'm answering your question correctly, but if you simply look at the atomic distribution, we don't see any signature. As Debbie has pointed out, we need a way to look either, if you want to see it in profiles and imaging, to look at pairs. And those phase diagrams show how far we could push the observation of pairs on both sides of the resonance. So we are really limited to a region around the resonance. On the other hand, there are other ways to look for the BCS phenomenon, maybe in collective excitation hydrodynamics, and I know John Thomas and Rudy Grimm will talk about it, and this does not rely on atomic profiles or imaging pairs, molecules, or atoms. This is really measuring the response of the total system and is probably quite different. There have been suggestions by Altman and Lukin that if you have a cloud of molecules or pairs, whatever, and it expands, you do a correlation analysis and identify pairs. So that's possible, and that would be a wonderful way to do it. On the other hand, it's very difficult if you have this picture you really need extreme high quality of absorption imaging in order to pick out any pair correlation. But I think it's on several people's mind to do that.
Wolfgang, I find your argument about the 80% condensate pair, I actually find that fairly compelling. I think it really does suggest that the pairs are small compared to the size. But I just want to make sure I understand your data. That's true at delta B equals zero. If I go out to your largest magnetic fields, that fraction is now down to 30%, yes?
Yes.
And then presumably Debbie, who goes, as I understand it, in dimensionless units, another factor of two further yet, maybe then at a place where the size of the pairs is perhaps comparable to or even larger than interatomic spacing.
Well, I think that's something I'm looking forward to discuss here at this meeting. When the condensate fraction becomes smaller, it can become smaller for two reasons. One reason is that the condensate fraction in terms of Cooper pairs has gone down, but the other reason is that our transfer technique has a smaller probability of observing this fraction. So my picture would be, but I'm waving all my hands in the nature of a workshop, if sort of the size of the pairs is comparable to the next neighbor, and if you would tell each atom, just quickly grab your next neighbor, that the condensate fraction may be 20-30%. So if you would say that you have a superfluid with 100% condensate fraction, you may be able to take this observed fraction and infer with a simple argument the size of the pass.
But in terms
of
convoluted. But in terms of what your data positively do say, they say at delta B equals zero, it's clear that the pairs are probably pretty small. But you don't really say one way or the other at the larger detunings.
No, but if you say the correct Cooper partner is as close as the other ones, you're really sort of, if you say each atom has six neighbors and one is the correct one, you would pretty much see that hand-wavingly you would say the condensate fraction observed is 10 or 20% if the Cooper pair size is such that it's identical to the next neighbor spacing. So somehow there are some constraints. Whenever you want to assume that there is a condensate fraction of 10 and 20% and higher, and it's really related to the physics of grabbing your next neighbor, then the size of the pairs should be distinctly smaller than the spacing. And with 80%, it just becomes dramatic. 80% means there's no margin for error. You always have to grab the right partner. But I don't have any more quantitative analysis than I just explained to you.
Okay, we're just going to have a couple more questions.
Emmanuel? If there's this condensate of pre-existing molecules, as you interpret it, can you say something on the 80% condensate fraction? I mean, what do you expect due to quantum depletion, let's say? If you are strongly on the Feshbach, very close to the Feshbach resonance, have very strong interactions, what are your estimates on the condensate depletion, actually, on such a strongly interacting system? Is that compatible with the 80% you get?
I haven't calculated, I mean, the condensate depletion is proportional, it scales with Na cube, and I haven't really calculated the prefactors. On the other hand, it's clear that in those systems, you can't take the scattering length at face value. Once the scattering length is so large, it drops out of the system. So maybe my intuitive answer would be, no matter what I calculate for the condensate depletion, even if the condensate depletion is larger than 20%, I would not be worried.
Well, that was basically my comment. I mean, we've heard the phrase condensate fraction at the Fermi in the BCS limit used several times. I'm not clear that everyone is using it to mean the same thing. I think we really do need a technical quantitative definition. Now, in fact, in the theory of superconductivity, there is one which I think most people would agree with. It doesn't seem to me to really have much in common with what some of the things that are being discussed. So I do suggest we try to actually define quantitatively what we mean by the condensate fraction in the BCS limit.
Okay, we'll have one more question and then we'll have a break.
Wolfgang, for your observation of the Feshbach resonance, interspecies Feshbach resonance, this means that now you can obtain a sign and a value for the scattering length between the two species, or?
Well, we should, but talking about the interspecies interaction between lithium and sodium, we have absolutely no idea, no theoretical guidance. We just, you know, tuned the magnetic field and kept our eyes open. So in principle, it should now be possible to feed those resonances into structure calculations, but nobody has done it. So we have no clue until now.
Okay, I think we really need to take a break. I was told that everybody who's a registered participant can pick up a KITP hat, and I gather they're outside by the door. Oh, they're out here. Okay.